Hey, it's Canzano. I appreciate you listening to the podcast. Make sure you subscribe and give us some feedback. Also, the Bald-Faced Truth podcast, it's brought to you by Shoe Mill, my favorite shoe store with locations in Portland and Salem and online at shoemill.com. Shoe Mill, where we put the world at your feet.
Initialize sequence.
Welcome to the Baldcast, a production of John Canzano's Bald-Faced Truth.
We've been talking about a lot of things on today's show. Amazon getting in the NFL business, staying in the NFL business, expanding their footprint. We've been talking about the NCAA. We talked with Jeff Schwartz. We talked with about the NFL draft. We talked with an expert on college branding and social media who talked to us about the value of this decision by the NCAA. We have talked about alcohol drinks to go in the state of Oregon and other things. My wife has popped in studio. I'm going to ask her opinion on that stuff. Ryan in Vancouver has popped in, and he is on the phone. Ryan in Vancouver, what's up, Ryan?
Hey, long time no talk. So my opinion on this alcohol would be a lot in Oregon to go. Bars working in restaurants in the past for myself, bars and festivals and stuff already, you can, and especially events, they hand out tickets, like raffle tickets, and you can get like two or three or whatever it might be. I don't know how the proposal's written, but they can definitely hand out like a ticket or two. And then once you're done with tickets, and you know, if a bartender's seen a person two or three times, they're going to know that, hey, you've exceeded your amount of tickets, so they can't get extra tickets from their friends or something. So it's a way to regulate it in the sense that people can still drink in the parking lot maybe or whatever, and or get their drinks to go and not be overserved.
Yeah, and I think some you know, municipalities are more used to this. Bourbon Street in New Orleans comes to mind, that I think they don't have an issue with it because they've been dealing with it for decades. And so they sort of get accustomed and anticipate what the problems are going to be. And, you know, I've been on Bourbon Street a few times, and, you know, when the police come down the street and they're riding horses, people move out of the way and people tend to behave themselves. I just don't know in Portland if it puts stress on law enforcement. That was my initial reaction, was this is going to stress out, you know, law enforcement, that and they're already stressed out. But Adriana was very excited about the possibility about buying a beverage. Anna, where do you stand on the idea of restaurants allowing to-go alcoholic beverages?
Well, I don't know that meat is much of a comparison, but I mean, look at what Ringside Restaurant did. They moved 2,000 pounds of meat in a couple of hours, selling off frozen meats that were going to go bad.
I didn't even know that.
Like, people lined up on Burnside and jammed up traffic for 2 hours to buy meat, and they sold out very quickly. So, I mean, if that's any comparison, I know that's not the same.
No, but I think the bottom line there is the restaurants are desperate to not waste food, stay in business, you know, try to get through this. Mm. And I have a lot of empathy for them because the margins in that industry are just so thin anyway.
I thought it was funny. I think it was Michael Russell with the Oregonian, the restaurant writer, who wrote today about Pock Pock, the place with the amazing chicken wings. And I guess Pock Pock is doing some version of that wings, like wings that you can pick up to cook at home. Mm. And I thought to myself, novel idea, but if I'm going to go pick up food, the whole point is that I don't want to have to cook it.
I also, I'm going to say, this is blasphemy. You and I went to Pock Pock. It's all right.
You got to try it again.
It's all right.
Come on. No.
Didn't blow me away.
Jeez.
It's okay.
You got to give it another chance.
It's all right.
I probably made too much of it. I had to undersell.
Not just
it.
You. Everybody talks about left and right. And I'm like, yeah, there's a lot of places that, you know, it's okay.
No, there's not.
Here's a story I just saw coming out of New York, business story. Everybody knows that the thirst for alcohol has increased since coronavirus began.
Yeah.
Beer companies definitely... definitely benefiting from this. But I was surprised that White Claw is killing it. Like, killing it.
Yeah.
Double-digit sales increase.
I'm not.
Miller Lite killing it. Natural Light killing it. Light beers and seltzers. The light seltzer drinks that that ruby grapefruit seltzers and all that, wild berry seltzers, spiked seltzers are winning.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because think about it. People feel like they're justified drinking a White Claw. Like, you see, you can rationalize probably downing a White Claw at noon more than you can, say, you know, hard liquor like a Manhattan.
So it's a guilt-free alcohol drink.
Right? Maybe.
But they, I mean, we have a friend who is, you know, a bigwig at White Claw. Uh-huh. We know him, Pete. And it's really interesting because I've asked him in the past, like, how is the product? This is before coronavirus.
Yeah.
Like last summer. How's it going? They can't keep it on the shelves. It sells anyway.
Yeah.
It's like the American stay-at-home mom. This is her go-to. Like, she would like to have the water dispenser with the 5-gallon jug of water filled with White Claw on the top of it.
Oh, you just came up with a really good idea for White Claw. Maybe Pete's listening. I know that on Recycle Day, if you go on a walk in our neighborhood on Recycling Day, before the recycling trucks actually come around, it's a little bit disturbing to see the amount of alcohol being consumed. I mean, I'm talking like, and you can't even buy the gigantic Costco-sized vodka here. So, like,
Are you talking about hard alcohol, or are you talking about...
Both.
Like, yeah.
I mean, there's, like, a friend was texting me on her walk. Like, she was just taking pictures. I know this is kind of nerdy, but she was just taking pictures of all of the full recycling bins that had, like, massive amounts of alcohol. People are clearly turning to that to get through this. And, like I was saying, like, somewhere somebody had bought... out of Oregon, the gigantic Costco size vodka. You know, you can't buy hard liquor here yet in Oregon like that. So somebody had bought that somewhere else and like finished it here.
Imported. Brad's in Oak Grove. He's called in. Brad, what's up, man?
Hey guys.
Hi.
Hey, not sure if I think it's a great idea or not to go alcohol, but not sure. But and I had a question for you. Is totally unrelated to what everybody's been talking about lately. But staying home a lot, watching a lot of TV, and yesterday I saw it was like a Dateline or something, and it was the story of Ward Weaver and the situation that happened up in Oregon City, and you were on the show interviewing him. Obviously, before you were married, because you were. And a song.
Like sing a song.
So I just had a question. When you were sitting there with that guy interviewing him, were you believing anything he was saying, or was it creepy, or just wondering?
No, that's a good question. And you get asked this every once in a while. Go ahead.
See, it was really weird. The interview was very strange. We had gotten a tip about the bushy-haired neighbor at the top of the hill. And this was in the midst, you know, both of the girls had disappeared. Nobody knew what had happened to them.
And full disclosure, like for people who don't know the history of this story, two girls in Oregon City have gone missing.
Yes, 2 months apart.
You're on the scene as an investigative reporter at Channel 2 in Portland at the time. And you are dispatched by your news director to go own this story.
Yes.
Go ahead.
So Ashley Pond and Miranda Gaddis disappeared 2 months apart. They were 12 and 13 years old. And, you know, we were struggling to figure out what had happened. Obviously, the FBI was, too. So we got this email. My news director said, go check out this tip. Somebody's telling us to go talk to the bushy-haired neighbor at the top of the hill from where the girls lived. It was literally his house sat between, you know, their apartment complex and the school bus stop that neither of them made it to the mornings that they disappeared. So I went out one evening after work on my own in my little Honda Civic and drove out there and knocked on his door.
Crazy.
I mean, this is just, you know, I don't know, investigative, like old school type journalism. Let me go check out the tip. He answers the door and I said, hey, why are we getting tips that you're, you know, that we should check you out? And he just kind of scoffed and said, well, I don't know. They keep calling me like the prime suspect in this. And I was like, well, why would they think that? And he's like, oh, I don't know. I failed like 3 polygraph tests, but I don't even understand why.
Okay. At this point, you are a woman.
Yeah.
In your 20s.
Yeah.
you are alone with a guy that would later turn out to be a serial killer.
Yeah.
And is there any part of you at this point that's going, maybe I shouldn't
No,
be here?
Because I think that's the part of me that just believes the best in everybody. Like, I think most of us don't want to look at somebody and think, oh, yeah, he most likely killed, you know, two little girls. And no, I maybe I was naive. I probably was naive. And so I set an appointment with him to do an interview with him. I said, if you're the prime suspect and you're getting all this flack, sounds like we should probably talk to you. He said, yeah, okay. So we set a time to talk the next morning at 7 a.m. because he had to work at a shipping plant or whatever. He had to get to work. So a photographer and I show up 7 a.m., and he is just really, really excited to talk to us. Like, he's got all kinds of nervous energy and has all kinds of alibis. I called it the shower alibi for how he couldn't have done this. I asked him to take me on a tour of his house if he had nothing to hide. And that is when, unbeknownst to me, he was walking me over the concrete slab where he had already buried Ashley Pond, and kind of leaned up against a stand-up freezer in his kitchen where we later found out at some point he had stored the body of Miranda Gaddis. And again, I mean, he was a dad. That was his connection to the girls. He had a daughter in middle school who was on their dance team. He bragged about how he would have these slumber parties with all the girls over, sleeping in his living room, and he was actually on camera saying you couldn't even walk in my living room without stepping on a body.
Because I think it's nuts. Okay, look, he did this. He's later convicted of this. Did he want to get caught, or was he excited by the idea that he wanted to share with somebody what he had done?
He was like the classic psychopath. I'm going to pull one over everybody. I'm smarter than everybody. I'm going to get away with this. I'm so smart that I'm going to taunt you with this and still get away with it. And so I remember leaving that day with my photographer, who was a very veteran photographer, Tom Agusti, and we turned and looked at each other and was like, well, what do you think? You know, I don't know. And I just wasn't ready. I'm never that quick or that ready to convict anybody in my head, because one of your primary jobs as a journalist is to maintain objectivity. And so there's no way that I could have left that day and gone, oh, yeah, he totally did it. You know, I just, even with the amount of evidence kind of in my face with how he was behaving, I just still had to maintain a level of skepticism about him in every way.
Now, to back up a little bit, first girl in Oregon City goes missing. And I know that you were on the beat and you were talking to other kids. You were going to the bus stop or the place that she was last seen. And you end up interviewing the second girl before she is taken and killed.
Yeah. Yeah. That was surreal when we realized that, because Ashley Pond disappeared on January 9th. And so between January 9th and March 8th, when Miranda disappeared, we had gone out several times and talked to kids at that bus stop. And the morning that Miranda disappeared and the news came out and I saw her photo, I was like, oh, my gosh. I talked to that girl. And we still had footage of her. Sorry.
It's okay. It to me, one of the, you know, and I didn't know you at that time, but later you can't help but get attached to the kids, the innocents, and now that you have children, you can't help but put yourself in the shoes of the parents and feel for those two girls that, you know, you were advocating on behalf of them, and here you were, you had spoken to her, and she became the next victim.
Yeah, I remember that conversation because she seemed like way older. Both girls had already lived, you know, hard lives, and they were loved by their families, but they definitely had tragedy already in the course of their lives. So Miranda had just struck me as somebody who was wise beyond her years, like she was, you know, a teenager going on 21. And it was the way she talked about her friend disappearing and how strange it was and that she thought she maybe had run away, but she wasn't sure. It just has always stuck with me. And I can't fathom how anybody can impart that kind of harm and violence on anyone, let alone a 12 and 13-year-old girl. Two 12, 13-year-old girls.
I know you don't love talking about this stuff because, in part, one of the things I know about you is, you know, you won an Emmy for your coverage of this, and you took black electrical tape and you put it over the name of Ward Weaver because he didn't, you know, you don't like the fact that's what you won an Emmy for. Like, that's not what you want to win an Emmy for. But I think there are so many people that we run into that the first thing they comment to me after all these years is they appreciated your coverage. They appreciated the human face that you put on it and that they were right there with you. They cared about those girls too.
Yeah, I think we all were aware of what was happening, and it had just dragged on for so long that it affected all of us as a community. I think it changed us. I think people became a lot more aware of the dangers that lurk in the families that are around you. I mean, the reality is, right? Like, the reality is that it's not going to be some stranger who harms your child. The reality is much more likely that it's somebody within your own circle or extended circle that's going to be harming your child, abusing them, and harming them in some way. So I think it opened the eyes of a lot of parents in our area.
You got the bald-faced truth. Want you to leave it here. Make sure you subscribe to the Bald-Faced Truth Radio Show podcast. You can do that anywhere you get a podcast. I noticed Brad in Oak Grove called back. He wanted to apologize for bringing up that topic. I think that's part of the authenticity of this show, Anna, and you talking about that experience in your life. I think it's interesting to people. I think it's powerful. And I think for everybody who gives journalists a bad name or tries to knock fake news and journalists, I mean, you were a young journalist who covered the hell out of that story and did a great job. You did your job.
Brad, you don't need to apologize. I mean, it is what it is, right? It was an incredibly tragic story. I felt like I got to know the families of those girls over that span of time because I was literally doing a story on their disappearances every day that I worked. And it's just real. I mean, if it's just a reminder to, you know, love your kids and protect them and be aware of who's in their life.
You bring up something. The families asked you to speak at the memorial service after. Adriana, during the break, was doing some research. And Adriana, you found a story where Anna got criticized by the LA Times for speaking at the memorial.
Yeah, they basically just said that she had crossed like a journalistic line of ethics. And that is so BS to me. Like, that is just, and I think that's honestly a part of what makes Oregon and the Pacific Northwest different, is that we do care about each other. And they may say that she crossed a journalistic ethical line, but like, she just cared. She was invested and she got asked to speak at the funeral. So like, why spend your day writing a piece about how this is so, this is crossing a line, whatever, get over yourself.
I think too, today, you wouldn't have been criticized today. Because right. I think today that's encouraged that you get close to the story. You got close to the story.
It surprises me that I'm as emotional. I mean, like, I wasn't expecting to break down as we talked about it today. I think it mattered to me that the families asked me to speak at the memorial service. It wasn't like just anybody. And how was I going to tell the families, no, I'm not going to speak when you've asked me to do this and somehow represent your emotions in this way? I thought, you know, I thought back then, yeah, that was a bad day when that guy wrote that piece criticizing me. And it was a bad day when I broke down crying on air, you know, the day that Miranda Gaddis's body was found. There was a moment in, there in August when the medical examiner's van pulled up and it was obvious that she was not going to be found alive. And, you know, I thought I was going to be fired for crying on air.
But it's what people remember. And people remember you were in that story with them. So thank you for sharing in this segment. We'll talk about something more uplifting tomorrow, but it's something that happened, and I think it's important. All right. Grab a podcast to this radio show.
We interrupt this broadcast with a special announcement from the Bald Face.
Hey, sorry to interrupt the podcast, but if you want to listen to more of the Bald Face Truth Radio Show, including more of this segment that you're listening to, make sure you subscribe on SoundCloud and iTunes to the Bald Face Truth Radio Show. Thanks for listening.